I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shiny.
Wendy.
Sally!
Darling. Light of my life. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
Welcome back to Chronologically. This is the podcast where we go through the full filmographies of some of cinema's greatest creators. My name is Jeff, and with me, as always, is Eric.
Hey, how's it going, Jeff?
It's going well. How about you, sir?
I'm doing super de duper, man. I'm having a great day.
Excellent. That's good to hear.
My wife made eggs.
Ooh. A delicacy in some parts. Well, this is season four, and we're going through the filmography of Stephen King, but right now we're just doing the 70s and 80s, and we've made it to the 80s now.
We have. And it was 1980, right? So this is probably filmed in, 79? And it came out in 1980. We are going to be talking about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Yeah, and a lot of the, what would I call it? The decorations, the what's going on inside this hotel is very 70s to me, and maybe older. So I do still think this is probably more 70s of a movie than an 80s movie, despite its release date.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. This thing screams 70s to me. But before we get going too much, Jeff, I kind of know a little bit about your history with this film, but why don't you share with the listeners?
So I've taken a little flack, but not much, for being somewhat of resistant to a lot of auteurs because I find them to be pretentious, or at least maybe their fans are pretentious. I don't know. And one of them is Kubrick, but I've seen two Kubrick films in my life. This and Eyes Wide Shut. And I didn't like either of them. Now, I will say I watched this when I was a teenager. And I think I didn't like it because it was creepy and it scared me. Right? Which is a good reason not to like something. But also, when that's what the movie's going for, it doesn't really say anything against the film. You know, like Event Horizon. I fucking hate Event Horizon because it fucks with me. You know, like it, and that's what it's going for. So that doesn't make it bad. It just means it's not for me. And so, like I said, I saw this when I was like 16 or whatever. I watched it in the dark, as one does. And at the time, I'm big into slashers. And those are just fun, goofy things. This is not fun. This is not fun. And I think that's what kind of got me where I couldn't sleep that night. And I'm just like, I'm not watching that shit again. And then when it came out, I saw it in theaters, Eyes Wide Shut. And I was like, this movie just sucks. Like, that movie sucks. And I think I saw it because I was, 18 at the time. And there was a lot of nudity. And so I think that's why I went to see that film. But I guess that's it for The Shining. I know it's one of the most well-respected. Everyone raves about it. One of my favorite movie podcasts is called With Corley and Rust, and they both love This Is It. You know, The Shining, man. It's like this perfect film. So it's just not an attitude I've shared. How about you?
Yeah, so I'm old enough that I remember when this film was in theaters. I obviously didn't see it. I was like 8 years old, but I remember.
Yeah, that would have been fucked up.
Yeah. I remember it being out. And I also remember when it was on heavy rotation on Showtime and HBO and stuff in the 80s. But I never did catch it. I definitely read the book before I saw the film. I was a very early Stephen King reader. I think I mentioned before that my grandma was feeding me these books when I was like 11.
She was your dealer.
Yeah. And I was all in on the book. I probably read it two or three times before I saw the film. I probably rented the film on VHS in high school. And watched it that way. And then, you know, I think I've maybe seen it two or three times since then, also on VHS. Mm-hmm. And my feelings towards the movie up until now were that it was kind of slow, kind of cold. It has like a really over the top Jack Nicholson performance.
Yeah.
I found Shelley Duvall to be kind of annoying. And I think also I'm going to probably definitively say that every other time I've seen this movie, I was probably drunk. Like, this feels like I'm going to drink some beers and watch The Shining sort of movie. So I came into this, like, I think probably because of the fact that I've shared with you that my wife bought me that Overlook picture, yeah, with us, our faces in it, and so on. Like, you might have thought that I was a huge Shining fan going into this.
I certainly thought so, yeah.
Yeah, definitely yes to the book, and then more a fan of the zeitgeist around The Shining than the actual film itself up, yeah, until now. Okay. But I will say, and I'm just going to tip my hand here right at the beginning, I bought the Blu-ray.
Yep.
And I watched this film big, and I watched it with a headset on, and I watched this. It's the first time I've ever seen it widescreen. It's the first time I've ever seen it with non-VHS clarity, right? Mm-hmm. So you could really take in all of that set design and all that fabulous 70s color and so on and so forth. And I think this is probably the first time I've watched it sober. It's the first time I've been, you know, like a parent probably that I've watched,
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Okay.
Man, did it hit different for me this time. Holy shit, did I love this movie. Oh my God. It clicked for me like I've rarely felt a film click for me before. You know how like some films kind of reward multiple viewings, like you see them again and you're like,
yeah,
like, that wasn't this. This felt like I was watching a whole new movie. Like, I don't know what it was, but man, I locked in on this thing. I watched it all by myself at night, alone in the dark with my headphones on. And wow, dude, like I was in it. Like I was really in it this time. And, man, I came away with this whole different like perspective on The Shining, on Nicholson, on Shelley Duvall, on Kubrick. I like thinking maybe I got to go back and watch some other Kubrick movies. Like I really, really picked up this huge appreciation this time. Maybe it's like an age thing. Maybe I had to be a certain age to get it. Maybe I just had to have like a certain openness of mind. Maybe I just needed to be like focused on it. I don't know. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was. God damn if I didn't love this movie, man. Loved,
yeah,
it. Where were you?
I'm glad. So this is the first time I've seen it since I was 16. This is only my second viewing. And now, like you said, this is obviously, you know, nearly 30 years later. And I am an adult and I've seen a lot of movies. And so I was able to follow the story a lot better. There was a lot of things that just kind of confused me when I was younger. Like, what is going on? What is happening? And this time, I feel like I had a much better idea of what was happening in the hotel and what was happening to Jack. And so I think from that perspective, I definitely enjoyed it more because I knew kind of an idea what was going on. Like I remember specifically the scene in the bathroom with Jack and that waiter guy who had killed his family and being able to remember, okay, that's the guy that was in that early scene that the hotel owner talked about, and things just kind of pieced together a little better. And I also watched this. So I rent things through Google and tend to watch them on YouTube. And there was like comment below. One of the comments was just kind of this thing. He's like, I just noticed this about how he said he sold his soul for a drink. And then at that point, that's really when things started gotten rolling.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so this is like demons here. Like there's some sort of, he sold his soul at this point, and the building is actively working against him. And so I definitely came out more positive than I did in the past. I looked at moments at Jack Nicholson's performance as being pretty brilliant, and then other moments being like, come on, like this is overacting. I mean, the Here's Johnny line honestly doesn't belong in this movie, right? To me, it's so silly of a line that in an otherwise dark and brooding film, I'm a little surprised Kubrick left it in. Like, and there are a couple of moments like that where, like, I think Jack Nicholson kind of overdoes it for me, but he's also really funny. Most of the time he spends at the bar chatting with the bartender, I found really funny. So I think in general, I'm more positive on it than, definitely more positive on it than I was before. I think visually it is a feast.
Oh my God. It is a feast. Like,
yeah,
the sets are unbelievable. Unfucking believable. Like, and again, I've only seen this on like an old school tube TV. And so to see it with all of the richness of color that it originally had, and like these cavernous rooms that they built, these giant, giant spaces that they built for these three people to inhabit. Like seeing it on this scale really sells this idea that they're in these enormous looming spaces, right? And they're all by themselves. And it really like kind of like focuses on that isolation, and not only like the isolation that the three of them have from the outside world, but also the way they're able to be like really isolated from each other as they're moving through the space, because it's so big they can lose each other for like hours at a time, right? The first thing that happens when they're touring the place is like the kid wanders off and somebody has to bring him back because it's so big.
Yeah.
You know, they can't keep track of each other. But yeah, I just, oh my God, some of these spaces, the red bathroom, like this is...
The red bathroom is kind of iconic to
this
me.
This is incredible. And like the actual room of 237 with that purplish greenish carpet, you know, that's going on in there, and the big gold ballroom, and oh man, that the room with the giant windows with like the Native American motifs at the top, you know.
Yeah.
I guess this is the first time that I was really able to kind of appreciate the visuals of the Overlook Hotel, you know, like I always, you know, took it in the story way, but this is the first time I was actually able to like really lock in and be like, oh man, this, because it looked so brilliant and new in the print that I was watching. And, boy, yeah, it is really something. And the fact that they build all this shit, it's just,
yeah, that's crazy.
Crazy. Like, on the Blu-ray that I watched, there's a documentary filmed by Kubrick's daughter during the making of this film. And it's really interesting because it starts in Nicholson's trailer and he's there like brushing his teeth, getting ready for the day. And he's in the costume. He's in like the red jacket, the Here's Johnny costume, you know? And, he's just kind of like goofing off and getting ready for the day. And then somebody comes to get him and they just walk through these corridors of what's clearly, you know, like a studio, you know, warehouse or whatever. And they come around the corner and boom, there they are in the lobby of the Overlook, right? Like it's just there. And it's really like cool to see, you know, how they built this whole thing, the hallways, like it's really something, quite the project, you know. Kubrick was a maniac.
Yeah. I and not only is the hotel visually stunning, but like the early parts of the film that are actually outside when they're driving up the hills and all that with the sweeping helicopter shot, which looked incredible. And one of my favorite shots is when they're driving up the hill. I think it's just Jack at that point. And the helicopter pretty much just goes right next to him and then swoops back off over the valley there. Looked awesome. And I think from a visual perspective, the movie is kind of undeniably superb and excellent. And I think, like, I get, again, I've only seen two Kubrick films, but I get it. I get why he is seen and held in such high regard. We'll get to the Shelley Duvall stuff, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Like, and that's more of what I hate about him. And I don't think genius is an excuse to be an asshole. And we'll get there.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to talk about the use of the Steadicam in this film because it's such a... It's an iconic Steadicam film, right? Because up until, like, the Steadicam got invented like a year before this movie was filmed, mm-hmm. right? And so up until that point, if you're going to have a camera swooping forward over the floor, you're laying down track, right? Like train track to have the camera move around on. And this, like, freed them of that, and they were able to have a guy just run through the hall with the camera. And so they took it and they flipped it upside down and put the camera really low to the ground. And that's how they get, like, those tracking shots of the big wheel going through, mm-hmm. which are, you know, iconic and everybody knows it. But again, for some reason this time, it really clicked with me, like, God damn, that's brilliant. Following that kid so closely on that big wheel as he's going across that carpet and then the floor and then the carpet. And it's
yeah, the hum. And yeah.
It's so freaking cool. And you're so close to him that it kind of sets up this tension of, like, what's going to happen when he goes around the corner? You know, like, what's he going to see there? And then, of course, in that shot, nothing. But a little later in the movie, totally, he comes around the corner and there's those little girls there. So it's like the payoff for that. But they do the same thing with the footprints out in the hedge maze at the end, where it's like it's following along his footprints as he's running and so on. And really sets up the idea, you know, without coming out and saying that, oh, Jack can follow his footprints through the snow, you know, mm-hmm. Because you can so clearly see them. And then, you know, he does that whole super smart kid backing up and, you know, almost cartoon like strategy to, like, back up in his own footprints and wipe the snow, you know, so he can go hide. But yeah, oh, it's so cool. Like, I just loved it. And again, seeing it big for the first time,
mm-hmm.
you just can't get that effect on TV, you know, like it's really hard to, like, feel as that those walls are, like, clipping past you as it's running down that hall, you know, and the furniture is like foof, foof, on the sides of you. It's like the trench run in Star Wars or something, you know, yeah. Like it's that effective of, like, that feeling of motion. I don't know. It's very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And I think because you mentioned the two girls too, just kind of going back to me being able to follow it, I think the first time I watch them, like, who are these kids? I don't get it. Like, and this time I'm like, okay, like, I'm tracking with this horrible thing that's happened. So, and this movie has generated a lot of theories and people's like, oh, this is what's going on. But the building has a memory and of horrible things. And so 237, the room, doesn't play as big of a part in the film as I remember it being.
Mm-mm.
It's no. Very brief. Like, he looks at it. Scatman Carruthers says, don't go in there. And then that's it. And then eventually they go in there and you get that scene with the naked lady. And that was it. And I'm like, that didn't really have that much to do. Like, the bigger tale was the tale of the guy who killed his whole family and those ghosts and him turning crazy and that being what happens to Jack and everything else. So I just remember that for some reason I was like, that's it, we're done, no more 237. Okay, fine.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of this stuff is explained in the book. And so, like, when I saw this film the first few times, I had the book fresh in my mind. And so as this stuff would happen, I would just kind of take it as a matter of course, right? Like, oh, now they're going to 237, da, 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 and here's what happened in that room. It's already in my head. And so this is the first time where I've seen the film where the book is, like, removed, you know, like, I don't have the book fresh in my mind anymore. And so it allowed me to realize that there are so many, like, what the fuck moments in this movie. Like, what is going on? You know, that doesn't, there is no explanation. There's no explanation in the film for what some of this stuff is, which makes it interesting and jarring and weird, right? Because the fact that the previous caretaker or caretaker way back when or whatever killed his family and stacked him in the corner or whatever, that's the only thing that we know about the history of the hotel. That and the Indian burial ground. And it's real unclear how which that plays like, into things. Little poltergeist.
Maybe don't do that next time, you know?
But, like, the reasons why that guy went crazy are undefined, right? But clearly a lot of other stuff has gone down in this space that we're just not hip to and are never made hip to, right? There's the guy standing there with the cracked open head saying, good party, isn't it? You know, who the fuck is that guy? Where'd he come from? Why is he there? What's going on with that dog blowjob? Like, what is Pooh that? Bear. Pooh Bear, yeah.
That's what it was. It was Blood and Honey years ago.
And so there's this, like, there's this feeling of history that is unrevealed to us in the same way that it's unrevealed to the characters. Like, we have the context that the Torrance family has, that there was this caretaker that went insane and killed his family. But we don't know, like, the greater context around this place. And you're right. Like, I think the hotel has a memory, right? And the idea that the hotel has a memory gives me the feeling that the hotel is conscious, almost. Like, it has character and motivations that are mysterious and deep and that we're just not hip to, right?
Yeah.
Like, almost as though, like, if the hotel gets enough memories, it gains consciousness like a rogue AI. It's a ghost-fueled AI hotel, right? And I think the hotel is personified by the guy in the bathroom and by the bartender. I think when those guys are speaking, they're speaking almost as the hotel, right?
Like, you don't have the guts, basically, is what they're saying at
manipulating
points.
Pushing, twisting, you know, and charming at the same time, giving him what he wants, you know, and twisting him around and so on. And so I think what ends up happening is that it's a big brain teaser that really doesn't have any solution besides the one that you want to give it as far as what's going on. And that leads me to the question that I have for you, which is, what is the hotel trying to do? Like, what's the hotel's motivation?
So I don't think the hotel, when I say the hotel has memory, yeah, but I don't actually think the physical building is what I'm talking about. I think there is demonic stuff happening. And demons is kind of like the one of the reasons I don't do demon movies is I don't, because they're scary, but also it feels like a cop out a lot of times. It's like the easiest place to go. It's like, if you can't explain it, demons. But at the same time, that's kind of what I feel like. There's just this evil presence here that has driven people mad. And so I think that is what is representative of the hotel. And if it's a demon, all they just want is death and darkness and evil, you know, like, it's just evil for the sake of evil is kind of what is going on, you know.
I think that's fair. Like, it felt to me like it was just trying to add to the collection, you know, like,
I think so. When you go through the movie and you see all these pictures on the wall, and then you get to that final shot of the movie with him in that picture from 1921, I really start to think, oh, this is the trophy room of all the people that this hotel has claimed. And that's what I start to think, because I think sure, he's in there now, but there's probably pictures of all these other people that it's claimed over the years. And
yeah, it makes me think about, like, when they are in that hotel and they are so isolated, time kind of loses meaning. Like it was cracking me up the way he was throwing those subtitles up, or not subtitles, but the title card, you know, Wednesday, you know,
like Tuesday,
May 4th or whatever, because it has no meaning, because you have no sense of time going by at all, or where what's happening, like in relation to the other events and so on. Like, and it also made me laugh how much those goddamn things scared me every time they popped up, because
bro, they were jump scares every time.
The sound.
Every time I'm like, oh shit, Tuesday. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit later about the sound mix, but goddamn, those title cards were like superb with like, yeah, having me jump out of my skin. But
and there were times too in the movie where the music would make you think something crazy's going on and terrible, but all it is they're just having some conversation. It's not even that eventful of a scene. Yet the music is swelling and pushing you for tension, and you're like, but nothing's happening.
I said the exact same thing to my wife, almost word for word, because she didn't watch it with me, so she's had to listen to 2 days of me ranting about The Shining. I said the exact same thing. Like, the music over just a regular conversation is just like propulsive and scary, and like, it's really fascinating the way it was done. And again, like, if anybody listening hasn't watched this film with a headset on, I wholly recommend it, because it's a very different experience when it's right there in your ears, because man, that music is like really high in the mix, you know, like you can still hear what everybody's saying, but the music is like really prevalent and it's wild shit. Like, there is some wild ass music in this movie.
One of my pet peeves in movies, and it's something that Kubrick has done, at least in this film, and then Ari Aster or whoever, the guy that did Hereditary, does, is I don't mind chilling music that creates atmosphere, but what I hate is ear bleeding high frequency buzzing, just like to piss me off. Like, I have to turn it down, and to me it's a cheap trick and I don't like it. And it started doing that. Like, I was thinking one thing while Scatman Crothers was in bed with his two painted pictures of naked women.
Thank you for bringing them up. Fabulous.
I was just like, what is he doing? I love this guy, but it's so out of character for this nice old guy that works at a hotel. And he's sitting there and he's got, you know, just two beautiful pieces of art of two naked women. But during that scene, that high pitched shrill, I'm like, oh, I had to turn down the volume, and it's just a pet peeve. And I think you can develop tension in other ways. Music develops tension, and there's a lot of times in the movie it does it without hurting your ears. Please stop doing stuff like this.
Yeah, I think it was trying to be like The Shine, right? Like, it's the sound of The Shining. Yeah. But yeah, it is irritating. Yeah, so I read there was a full score written by these two ladies, and it was a full like electronic Moog score. So it's like, well, like the music that's playing at the beginning while he's driving through the mountains. And that's the only piece of the score that survived. Kubrick shit canned the rest of it and just pulled music out of other places. Like, at one point, after Wendy finds the all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, there's like those real high shrilled, like just tinkling strings. He pulled that from a Doctor Who episode and just used the Doctor Who music. He just plugged it in. Yeah. Apparently a big fan of like finding things already in existence and just using them, you know, in his own way. But yeah, like the rest of the music in the movie is the same. It's all just shit that he found in other places and just plopped into the movie because it worked, which I think is kind of clever and fascinating and weird and a bummer for those two ladies that wrote the whole score.
Yeah, which is weird to me, because you see someone like him or like Nolan that you think that they want all the pieces to be original to them, or at least that's what I would assume, right? These artists that take themselves this seriously, I would think they'd want their own pieces, but no, he's just like, I'll take that one of these and just sandwiches it in, which is
very, very
kind
much
of interesting.
So. I think very particular about what those pieces are. but not necessarily demanding that they be original to him. It was the same thing with like the hotel rooms and some of the design. He sent like people all over to photograph hundreds of hotels and then was just like, okay, this is going to be that, and this is going to be that, and this is going to be that. Just rebuild this shit that you just took pictures of, and that's what we're going to use as our set, you know, like, yeah. Which is interesting, because again, you would think like you would have just this huge original thing. And I'm not saying like some of these elements aren't original, but I think they were definitely inspired by, you know, these real places. And you're just like, fuck it, good enough. Let's use that, you know, which is interesting when you take into account how particular he is about other things, you know, particularly yeah. the performances, legendarily making people do things 100 times to get. So while we're talking about that, I wanted to go back up to what you were talking about, Jack being kind of over the top at points. Another part of this documentary that was pretty fascinating, there was this guy who was there on set. And he was like, so here's how it works, right? The first few takes, Stanley says, you know, action. And the actor gives, like, everything they've got. They give, like, the whole performance. They give him what they think he's looking for. And he's like, that's great, do it again. That's great, do it again. Eventually, the actor gets tired. And they start, like, being more reserved and holding it back because they're, like, exhausted because they've been doing the same thing over and over again. And, you know, he just keeps giving them the, that's great, let's do it again, that's great, let's do it again. Until they hit the point where the actor is confused and just doesn't know what the hell he's looking for. So they start making faces and saying crazy things and doing weird stuff and making crazy noises. And then that's what he put in the movie. Like he basically tormented them into insanity and then used like the like complete abandon at the end, and that's what he took and put in the movie. Like he's like, that's the crazy that I'm looking for, is I've driven you actually crazy and you don't know what to do. That's what we're going to use in the film. And so that's why in all these takes, like, Nicholson is so over the top, because he's flailing, like he doesn't know what to do. And so they took that craziness and just shoved it into the movie, which I think is fantastic. Similarly, and unfortunately, while we're here, we might as well talk about Shelley Duvall. You know, by all accounts, including those of other people on the set, not just her, and Nicholson backed it up, he psychologically tormented her into yeah. that performance. You know, like, he was mean to her, he was rude to her, and he pushed and pushed and pushed to... according to him, even keep her off kilter to get that nervous performance out of her. And you know, according to her, it did like permanent psychological damage to her, like making this movie kind of fucked her up for life. Which in this case, like I agree with you, wildly not worth it, you know, like.
Yeah. And anyone yeah. can kind of go and look at where Shelley Duvall has ended up. And sort of the later stages, she's dealing with a lot of mental illness. Not that I can say for certain that this is the reason, but it is one of those things where if you're hiring an actor, you're hiring someone who's been trained to do what you need. And instead of mysteriously not telling them what you need and forcing them to go crazy and then just using your own sadist takes on things to put in your film, it pisses me off, you know, and I don't think that just because you're considered this genius that you have to be an asshole. Because if you were a genius, you could probably figure out another way to do this. And if you're a genius, you can hire the actors who can give you the performances you're looking for without mentally treating them like shit. And and that's like one of the main reasons I don't like Kubrick. He is a narcissist, and you know, your art isn't that fucking hot, bro. Like, sure, people love these movies, but Hitler was an artist too. You know what I mean? Like, he did paintings and shit. But it just, I mean,
Well, apparently he did the same thing to Scatman Crothers.
The woman and the black guy. Got it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he made him refilm that scene where he's talking to Danny and explaining The Shine, like 70 times, you know, over and over and over again, until finally, you know, Scatman broke down in tears and was like, what do you want? You know, like, what are you looking for? It's interesting. I don't even know if he knew what he wanted. Definitely uncool. Like, there are some really spectacular elements to this film, and I really do enjoy it. And we kind of have established the rule on this, you know, on our podcast, that we separate the art from the artist. We don't dwell too much on people who are assholes. But in this case, this person was an asshole in the making,
in the production of the film. This isn't, you know, the film sexual is a result that happened off scene.
Exactly. The film is a result of his assholeness. So I kind of feel like it's fair to address it.
Right. And I want to say too, that's like the main reason I don't like him. Like, that shittiness, you don't have to do that, because there are other movies where people pull incredible performances from actors who aren't assholes, you know, directors who aren't assholes, excuse me. And it just is like, all it is him exercising some level of control and torment over someone, because that gets him off somehow.
Yeah. Now, that said, okay, so let's set that aside. What did you think of the Shelley Duvall performance?
She's magnificent. She's really, really good. And I think Shelley Duvall is a great cast too, because there is something that is sort of relatable about her, that she is kind of a normal person, right? To mm-hmm. me, like, I see Shelley Duvall, I see just a person. And I think her slow breakdown makes sense. And I think the character's incredibly brave and protective of their child. And, you know, like, here he's already kind of got this edge to him. And then when she thinks that he's hurt Danny, she doesn't give a shit if he tries to hurt her. She's going to say what she's feeling in that moment, because now you've wounded her child. I think she's excellent at both being afraid and being brave, because there's lots of moments of bravery from her. And I think she's fantastic in the movie.
I agree. This is also maybe the first time that I've seen this movie where I really kind of put together the fact that she's the only one who doesn't see what's happening in the hotel firsthand, right?
Till the end
when it tips its hand to her. But something that had never occurred to me ever before this viewing of the film is that Jack has The Shining as well. It's not just Danny. Like, it's hereditary, right? It's passed down. Scatman Crothers says it at the beginning. It's hereditary. He didn't get it from her. She's not seeing what's going on here, right? So Jack has it on some level. He's tuned to the hotel, right? And so it leads to this, like, this trifecta of fragility almost, right? Like, they all have their own perspectives on what's going on. None of them see any of the other's perspectives, right? Like, they can't see what Danny's seeing. Danny can't, well, he can hear what's going on with them. But, like, Jack is having this completely other experience from the rest of them, because the hotel is, like, just digging into his psyche. And then she's off on her own, damaged in her own way. Like, clearly at the beginning when she's talking to the doctor and everything, she's already been through some shit, you know, like, chain smoking, nervous, playing with her hands, like,
doesn't want to admit the story.
Yes.
Right. That he's an abusive alcoholic, and like, oh, it could have happened to anyone. It was an accident.
Making excuses for him. And he's better now. Yep. He doesn't drink anymore and so on and so forth. And it's like
typical
you said,
abused spouse.
Exactly. So she's coming into it already from this place of vulnerability. And so you take this dynamic of these three different people with these three different experiences and then just like bounce them off each other in this space while they're all having these different moments. I mean, you can really see when you look at it like that, why she would be like, what the fuck is happening? Like, why? What is happening to my husband? There's no liquor here. What is happening? Like, why is he so insane, you know? And so, like, when you look at it from that perspective and you see, like, how much she falls apart and still manages to, like, hold it together enough to fucking beat him in the head with a bat. it's you're right. It is a very impressive and, I think, layered performance, more so than people give her credit for. You know, like, I think a lot of the feedback initially, at least, was that she's just shrill and dumb, you know, and I don't get that at all, either from the performer or from the character, you know.
Yeah,
like when she first shows up, I'm kind of like, oh, she's kind of a rube, you know, like she's got this little accent to her and she doesn't seem terribly bright. But as the movie progresses and you kind of like see what she's going for and how resourceful she can be in this situation, I think it's just great. I think it's really great. I think the kid's great too. I think that kid is like fantastic.
Yeah, definitely one really, and especially when he does the voice of, is it Tommy?
Tony.
That lives in his mouth? Tony?
Yes. Creepy as shit.
And he does that, like he does a great job of not being home, right?
Yes.
Like in his head. And then he does a great job of being afraid and all of that stuff. So I guess we should talk about Tony. What is Tony?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different takes on what Tony is. In the book, Tony is future Danny feeding him information, right? Like reaching into the past and feeding him information. There's nothing to suggest in the film. And I really feel like the film should be considered a separate experience from the book because it is very different in a lot of ways. Yeah. So I think in terms of the film, Tony could be Danny's way of psychologically partitioning, you know, his psychic abilities, you know, and it just kind of, interpreting what's happening to him, you know, you put it through a child's lens, you know, like he's being fed all this information that he doesn't know where it's coming from. He invents this friend that's giving it to him, right?
So my argument to that would be there's the time where he's in bed and he's not here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, he's gone to go get Scatman.
Right.
So all that's left is Tony.
All that's left is Tony, which kind of implies that Tony's like a separate entity. So then it could be, you know, like a split situation where we've got multiple personalities, or it could be that Tony really is a separate entity. And despite his surface level creepiness, seemingly an entity on the side of good. You know, Tony gives warnings. Tony saves them. Tony wakes them up when Jack is on the way, you know, and gets the mom up and moving when Jack's going to show up with that axe. You know, Red Rum is a warning. It's not, it's not a threat. It's a warning. Get up. It's time. We got to fucking go, you know? So I don't think that Tony is, if he is a separate entity, I don't think that he's a demon. I don't think that he's a ghost.
No, he's good, right?
He's good. He's like an angel.
He doesn't
want
to go to that hotel. He's like, I don't want to go there, man.
Right.
Some fucked up shit's going to happen. So he definitely not evil.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I know. Wait, where do you land on Tony? What do you think?
I just kind of believe that this is some entity that is unexplained, a spiritual guide, maybe. of his ability. If we're going to go with my theory that the hotel is filled with demons, that means that there could be angels, and it could be a protective angel, if that's where I'm going with it. You know, I do think it is, Tony is its own entity because of the scene where, oh, Danny's gone away, you know, and yeah. That by Danny, or at the very least by Danny focusing on contacting Scatman, his consciousness isn't there anymore. So I do think it, Tony is more of its own animal and person.
Yeah, which leads me to other angelic forces, Scatman himself.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a whole other book or film about that character that we're never going to get that I would love, you know.
I want to know what he knows about 237.
I want to know what he knows about the whole damn place. Like, he's there. Yes. Like, he stays. Like,
I specifically want to know about 237. Like, what are, like, why? Like, what did you go in there for some reason? Like, why would the chef need to go in there? But,
there's naked ladies
and
in
go,
there.
Oh gosh, you know, like, how do you know about 237?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I view him like, I've made up my own backstory for him, that he started working there in the 1950s and he's been there ever since, like, keeping an eye on things and acting as, like, a not a caretaker, but almost a caretaker. Let's call him a spiritual caretaker of the mm-hmm. hotel, and issuing warnings and serving as, like, a guidepost to people and so on. And it's interesting that he chooses to stay. He chooses to come back. Like, it's almost like his calling. Like, he is there maybe to protect people from the hotel, you know? And then he realizes that he has fucked up and not protect them enough. And then, you know, of course, in the end, the hotel wins. The hotel gets him, you know, which is
yeah.
a tragic ending to that character's story. But I feel like that story
that was the one
is so
part
much richer
in the movie.
Than what we're getting in the movie, you know?
Yeah, that part of the movie in the original, obviously this time I knew it was coming, but when Scatman gets killed in the original, my first viewing, I was so angry. I was so pissed off because I'm thinking he's coming to save the day. In a lot of ways he does, because he brings the snow cat there.
Yeah.
But I was so mad.
It totally subverts your expectations, right? And it's yeah. been enough time since I've seen this. Like, I remember that he died, but I didn't know the specifics. I kind of felt like he was going to interact with them in some way besides catching an axe to the chest. But he yeah. doesn't at all. Like Danny and Wendy never even see him until she sees his dead body, like, during her freak show tour of nightmares in the hotel. But yeah, it really does subvert your expectations when he, like, they make such a thing of him coming and flying and booking the snow cat and getting over there, and then he just catches one fucked. And dies.
Yeah, like, he doesn't do shit.
It's funny.
Which sucked, because he was, like, so, like, he's, yeah, he's so nice and kind and, yeah.
I did have a thought this morning, and it's just a half-baked thought, but it was relating to the fact that domestic violence reports went up during COVID isolation,
mm-hmm.
and how that relates back to this film, and the idea that if people are trapped in a space with their families, even without ghosties, they kind of tend to go a little nuts, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was I don't know if there's room for discussion there or not. I just thought it was an interesting
moment. Yeah, I don't really have much to add to that. It's not a surprise, but I do think that that's apparent.
So do you think coming into the film, like at the beginning, during the interview, do you think Jack is already kind of fucked up? Like, we know he was an abuser. We know he's an alcoholic. But do you think that sober Jack is kind of nuts coming into it in the first place?
I think he's a bad husband. Even, okay, like I've said many times, I'm familiar with alcoholism, and it doesn't always present in physical abuse, but it did there. But he admittedly said, I'm done, and stopped for 6 months. And, you know, and in that way, hey, he's learning a lesson. But he never is kind to either of his family members. Like, he gets on the phone with his wife. He's very dismissive with her. When they're in the car driving up to the hotel for the first time, you just look at his face. He's not really there.
Mm-mm.
Right? Like, his son is asking questions. That's kind of annoying. And his wife kind of annoys him. And he's just not really there. And so I think that he's already prone to being turned. And I think that there's obviously a lot of shame around, like, what happened between him and Danny. But then there's the moment when he's starting to go crazy and Danny comes into the room and he's like, come over here, Danny. And Danny's like, I don't know. And he sits him on his lap and he's like, I love you. I'm not going to hurt you. And I think in that moment, the character believes that and is, you know, I don't think without the hotel, he goes crazy and kills people, but I don't think he's a good husband. And I think he's already cold, and just being in the hotel kind of turns that up. And you can go back to alcoholism, because what alcoholism does is it kind of brings out the real you in a lot of ways. Like, I'd say the real you, but the you are without inhibitions, without yes. worrying about consequences. And the him is abusive, and the hotel is like his alcohol, and it kind of lets him loose into that. You know, I always say, like, for me, when I used to drink, when I get drunk, I'm a hugger. Like, I'm, hey man, it's good to see you. Like, that's where I go. But for him, it's violence. And so
same, I get to the point where I feel like I get too handsy. Like, I've regretted it.
Like, what the hell's wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I get way too affectionate. And it's like with people that maybe I shouldn't be that affectionate with. Right. Like, anybody who's around, it's like, hey, and it's not a great scene. Yeah. Same. No more drinks for me. I've drank my life's allotment.
Oh, well, I've gone through that. I did it, but then I had a heart attack, and, you know, so I'm like, yeah, I wasn't that into it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so I do think, to answer your question, yeah, he's already broken.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel in some ways, like, I think alcohol is used as a tool in this film to kind of break down any barriers that he had put into place, you know, like, I think in some ways, if you drink enough, alcohol opens a door in your mind, and God only knows what it's letting in. You know, like, when you drink to the point where you're blackout drunk, an argument can be made that that's not you anymore. You know, it is, but it's not necessarily. Your body's walking around and doing shit without your knowledge, and you don't remember it. Right. So I'm not implying that, like, when you're blackout drunk, you're demonically possessed. But I would say if demonic possession was real, it seems like you just opened a gate, motherfucker. Like,
yeah.
And so I think in that's the way that alcohol is kind of used in this film as well. You know, like it's just to help break down any resistance that he might have had, and just let it all in, you know?
Yeah.
So here's a question. If your career wasn't going so hot and you needed money, you're a guy with a wife and a son.
Mm-hmm.
Would you accept this job? Like, forget the caretaker situation that happened in the past.
I totally would, because I like the idea of having this gigantic place to myself. I'm a homebody anyway. Like, you mentioned COVID causing you know, violence rates to go up like that. My wife and I didn't get more annoyed with each other because we were pretty much as home as much as we were anyway. Right. We just like, it's just normal. We're always home. So an idea of being away from the world for a while And really, my only responsibilities are to turn on the heater once in a while. I think I would jump all over that. I'd load my Kindle up with books and just have this quiet place to myself where no one could come and get me. Oh, the phones are down? Darn. You know, like, I just kind of, there is an appeal to that. And then you go and you have this gigantic kitchen with everything you could ever want tool-wise to use to cook yourself a good-ass meal. And I just, I totally would, and maybe just once, you know, 1 6-month stay, and I probably wouldn't do it again, but I think there's something about that that I find appealing.
Yes, 100%. I'm 100% on board with everything you just said. Yeah, man, load up the Blu-rays. And they still, I mean, even in the 1980s, they still get TV. They're watching Roadrunner. Like, they can watch television. I mean, just pre-VCR times, but they can still watch television up there and then take a bunch of books. And yeah, to me, that feels very cozy and homey. And
go play in the snow.
Go outside, hang out in the maze. Totally. Yeah, we're going to get outside today. We're going to go play in the maze. You know,
get
I'm sure
the
there's
snow
a
cat going and drive around, make a snowman. Like, I wouldn't want to do it every year.
Yeah.
You know, because I would probably start to resent it. But one time, I would totally do it.
Or maybe every other year. Like, I could see getting on like a cadence of maybe every 3 years.
Yeah.
If you could set something like that up, you know, like, ooh, this year's the year I'm going to the hotel. I'm going to eat all all the pimento pieces that they inexplicably have in that kitchen.
Yep. Hey, that little thing with the, you got all that lamb shank. And it's like, I've never eaten lamb. I mean, I have, but I don't eat it regularly.
Right.
Like, I would have lamb every night.
We're
you
making
know?
This
I'd
whole
learn how to
shank.
Cook lamb.
There's three of us like, making this big ass thing. Let's do it.
Take the time to learn really some good culinary skills in that kitchen. Like,
it feels like
I'm
a sweet gig. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that said, as a Floridian, as a native Floridian, I think, right?
Yep. Born and raised.
Yeah. What's your experience with snow? Have you ever been snowbound?
Bound as in snowed in?
Yeah.
No, never. So snow-wise, I think I've seen snow 3 times. The first time we were, I know my mom's family's from Ohio, and we were visiting, and there was snow on the ground already. And then I went to Washington, where my wife's family lives, and there was snow on the ground already. And actually, this past January, I went up to visit my mom in North Carolina, and it snowed. And I actually got to see the snow falling, and it was really cool. And that's about it. Like, I've never had the bad stuff that comes with snow. It's always been the, whoo! Yeah, I just, that was it, you know?
That's cool. Yeah, it fascinates me as somebody who grew up. I live in Columbus now, but I grew up in Toledo on the lake. And in the 70s and the 80s, it snowed a lot more up there than it does now. Global warming is a thing, folks. It is totally happening because it used to be that we'd have snow on the ground from Thanksgiving through Easter always. Like, it just didn't melt, you know, when I was a boy. And I'm old enough to remember the blizzard of 78, which up north here is legendary. Snow got up to the second floor of people's homes. And school was down for at least 2 weeks, maybe more, while people like dug themselves out. And I remember after 5 or 6 days, my grandmother and my mother packed my sister and I on the toboggan, and we went on what they termed the Great Adventure, where we dragged the toboggan to the grocery store to get groceries because we were running out of food and there was no way to get there. And so we took a fucking sled to the grocery store to get food, you know, and bring back to the house. So yeah, I have been snowbound on a limited way. And then of course, since then, you know, there've been various snowstorms that, you know, like once every 4 or 5 years now, we still get pounded pretty good to the point where stuff shuts down, you know, and the city goes quiet for a day or two. And it's fascinating when it happens. But that said, I'm in the middle of the city. Like,
Yeah.
There's a difference between that and being like Donner partied out somewhere, you know, and being stuck. But that said, like, these people are in a primo snowbound situation. Like you said,
they've got lamb
shanks and Campbell's soup. Like, they're good. You know,
That's when I'd want to be snowbound in that situation. I'd want to look out the window and be like, oh, baby. It's funny you mentioned global warming. That reminded me. I was watching, I think it's when Scatman Carruthers is watching the news, or maybe it's Shelley Duvall, and they're like, there's a heat wave. You know, it's snowing over here. It's bad. But down in Florida, there's a heat wave. It's going to be in the 90s. I'm like, 90s. That's downright cool for us in the summer. Like, I was like, nowadays, global warming is like, it is hot.
Yeah.
90s, that ain't shit.
That's why I'm moving further north, dude. I can't tolerate that shit. I always say, when it's cold, I can get warm. When it's hot, I can't get cool. Like, there's no...
Well,
like,
that's...
I can't...
The same here. You can always put more clothes on, but you can only get so naked.
Exactly. 100%. Mm-hmm. So, I know from some of our past episodes that you've never been to, like, see a psychic, right? But I don't know if we've ever discussed, like, where you're at on psychic abilities. We've discussed prophecy, but that's not the same thing. Do you feel like anybody, even in a latent, slight way, has any sort of precognition or psychic abilities? Do you feel like that's a thing at all? Does that exist in the world?
I've talked about, I watch a lot of true crime, and there have been times where, like, someone who has lost a loved one will get a message from their family member, and I believe that's genuine. Brian Regan, who's a great stand-up comedian, has a thing about psychics. He's like, we got to talk about these people. And then he stops himself. He goes, now, I'm not talking about those of you that have a connection with a loved one. He's like, that's very real and genuine. But these other folks, you know, you're what's her name? Brown. What,
Sylvia Brown. Yeah.
Sylvia Brown and all that. They are so full of shit. Basically, my opinion, I think I said this about prophecy as well, or something along the lines, if they're charging for it, they're fake. That's a sham. You know, like, I'm not going to discount anyone who has a belief in something psychic or something extra going on in the world. But I will warn you, if they're charging you for it, they're fake. And I think the best way, I was thinking about this recently, of showing you that you might have gone to a psychic and been convinced. They've said something that convinced you. I challenge you to watch Impractical Jokers, one of the best shows on television ever. And there's several of the scenes where they're pretending to be psychics and they're turning over cards. And the guy, I don't know if you've ever watched it.
I'm familiar with it, but I haven't watched it.
It's so good. But so they do what the other guys are telling them, right? And so he's pretending to be a psychic. One of the guys will say, hey, tell him Tom's going to die. And he'll say it. And he goes, oh, yeah, Tom is in the hospital. And they're like, wait, really? You know, and it's just that kind of, and these guys aren't psychics. They just, you just get it right once in a while.
Right.
And psychics are trained to speak in enough generalities that if, especially in front of a crowd, they're going to hit. And I think that they're just trained manipulators. That being said, I think there are times where people get something outside of themselves that is beneficial to them, that is important. And I don't discount it in any way. I don't try to science it away. Hey, that's important to you. Take that with you.
So I always think of it in terms of the final destination test. Like, you're on a plane. The plane's about to take off. Somebody on the plane flips the fuck out and starts screaming that the plane is going to crash. They just saw it. The plane is going to explode. Whatever. Do you stay on the plane? Or are you one of the people that gets off the plane?
I think at that point, the plane is probably not going anywhere anyway. I personally would stay on the plane because I would more think of that person probably has a mental illness of some kind or maybe a fear innate anyway. So me personally, nah, it's like, cause it's like the whole, you know, after September 11th, there were a lot of stories of people who called into work that day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they can attribute that to, and again, I'm someone who believes in God, but they'll attribute that to, hey, God saved me. But there are 3,000 and some odd people who didn't call in that day. You know what I mean? And so I also, there is a skeptic part of me along with the faith-based part of me. And I think that's healthy to weigh both sides equally. And so I get it, you know. But I would never tell someone who's like, you know, I heard from my late dad that he's proud of me. Yeah, man, that's awesome. And I would leave it at that. Like, because I don't know. I don't honestly know. You know, I tend to lean more on the skeptic side of things, more so than anyone else who claims themselves to believe in God. Probably I'm just like, I take everything as, you know, tangible as possible, I guess is the way I'd explain it. But
interesting. I think I would also stay on the plane, but I'd be pretty unhappy on that goddamn plane.
You're unhappy on the plane anyway.
I know, it would make me really unhappy on the plane.
So what's funny, we were talking about me liking the idea of being isolated in this hotel. That's why I like flying. Is I get that 5 hour, like when we go to Washington, it's a 5 hour flight for us, it's six. I get that time where no one can ask me for anything because what am I going to do? I'm stuck on a plane. My cell phone's off. I get to read in silence, you know, and even if someone's talking, I got earbuds, I'll plug them in and,
you know,
I'm off listening to an audiobook.
I just flew out to LA a couple weeks ago and I did my best to channel you on that flight. I was actively thinking of you. And I had a bunch of movies downloaded and I did my best to like watch the movies and enjoy my time and not flip out. And for the most part, it worked. It didn't hurt that it was like these were two of the smoothest flights I've ever been on in my entire life. Had things gotten a little turbulent, I don't know. I think my Jeff channeling would have gone out the window. But I was able to mostly successfully chill on the plane. So
it's funny because my flights, so this flight I took to North Carolina was the first time when I got back, I'm like, I think I'm good on flying for a while. Not because it was particularly bad, but there's a lot of off and on. And I had to sit next to strangers where usually when I travel with my family, we're all together. But on the second leg of one of my flights, we went weightless.
Oh,
we hit that turbulence. Oh. And it wasn't like you get a little bit sometimes and you're like, this is normal. We hit it and everybody went up and then came down and then looked around and most people were laughing. They're like, oh, holy shit. And for me, I'm like, it felt like a roller coaster amount of weightlessness. And it was like 1 second, and that sounds short, but 1 full second is a lot on an airplane because it's like we're dropping.
Yeah, that's the sort of story.
That was one of the few times where I was like, ooh, my butt puckered on that one.
Yeah, that's terrifying to me. So, okay, last question. What do you think happens next at the Overlook Hotel after The Shining, right? Those two people end up down somewhere after the snowcat. Jack's frozen in the maze. What happens in the spring? What happens the next winter? What do you think? What do you think goes on?
So
there?
I think that they get, so Shelley Duvall gets down to whether that police station is down there, and says, "Hey, my husband's trying to kill me," or whatever. They obviously don't arrive till at least the morning because it's daylight when you see him frozen in the snow. So they go and they get him and he's dead and they take him to the morgue or whatever. Come the spring, they open up as usual, They try to hide this as much as possible, but it adds to the legend. And they hire someone desperate enough to come back. It happens again, right? I think that that's the cycle that the hotel takes. It just
It's funny. It's funny because, like, when you watch the beginning of the movie next time, you have to watch it with the perspective of, like, the manager of the hotel, who, I have to say, fabulous outfit, fabulous hair, smooth criminal. Like, that guy is 100% a used car salesman.
Oh, yeah.
Because he knows. He knows. You know, he's done this before.
But he doesn't.
He'll do it again. Cover.
Yes, I think he knows that something crazy has happened here. I don't think he thinks it's anything beyond a one-off.
You don't think that should manifest during, like, the busy time of the year? Like, in some ways? Like, the staff has to have stories of the crazy old lady in 237. They have to have stories of, my God, the blood and honey blowjobs. Like, they have to it has to occasionally creep through the cracks during the busy times while the presidents are staying there, right? Like, I don't know, it makes you wonder.
I get the feeling it doesn't.
No,
like, I feel like in a lot of ways, you know, like, bats are nocturnal, they're awake at night, and I think that the hotel is asleep during the summer. It hibernates.
It bides
and then
its
winter
time.
It wakes up, right?
Right.
So that's how I would explain that.
It's like it hides for 34 years.
Yeah,
whatever,
and I think people being around drives things back, right? The cockroaches, you don't ever see cockroaches when you've got a house full of people, but when the lights go out, the cockroaches come out, you know.
Right, right. The Overlook Hotel is a cockroach. Good one. So, okay, final thing, and then we can wrap. Where are you at now on The Shining? Like, after watching it, after our discussion, I think it's totally legit to still not like Kubrick, especially on a personal level. But where are you at on this movie?
Yeah, and again, most of my distaste is that. And I also don't like movies that make me feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people do. But I can't fault the artistry of how it looks, you know, and the story. I can fault the director for being an asshole. But I think I understand why people love it. It is kind of a fun movie to talk about. Like, what's happening with that? What do you think's going on? To theorize and stuff like that. So I would call it a good movie. It's still, like, to me, I thought about it after finishing and I'm like, I still prefer Carrie. You know, I like Carrie way more as a movie. I sit down and I enjoy Carrie. This, I get, there is a moment about three quarters of the way through where I'm like, oh, come on. it just keeps taking its time. But then you get the Red Rum reveal of murder. And in hindsight, when I think about it, I'm like, that's kind of stupid. But in the moment, it's like, it gave me chills again.
Me too.
You know, when she hugs him and she sees it in the mirror.
It worked for me. And it has that corny zoom, you know, that super fast zoom. And it totally worked for me. Like,
yeah. And it got me shivering. I'm like, woo, it did it again. It did it the first time and it did it again. So I think there's a lot to love here.
Cool. Very cool.
And I'll leave it at that.
That's fair. That's fair.
And it's obviously right. Rose in your estimation as well.
Oh, so much. It just hit a sweet spot for some reason and, like, shot up the list, you know, like a bat out of hell. So, I was pretty excited by this one. So what do we got coming up next?
Bro, I didn't even bring up the damn thing. One sec. I meant to check while I was watching the movie because I always like to think, oh, hell yeah. Okay, so next we're going to watch Creepshow.
Oh, shit, really? Already?
Yeah, man. I haven't seen this in ages.
Me either.
Creepshow.
I haven't seen it in a really long time.
We get to see Stephen King himself on screen. We get Leslie Nielsen, which is, like, my favorite thing of all time. A less problematic Twilight Zone is what we're headed to, I think.
Oh, I am jazzed. Hey, is Creepshow 2 anywhere on our list? Is that?
I believe so.
Did that make the cut? Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's coming up in a few months. But yeah, we get Creepshow next. Man, we're running into a big slate of awesome here.
That's fantastic.
The stuff that's coming up, all of it I'm looking forward to. Like, I even said last time, I'm like, I'm not in a big rush to watch The Shining. Kind of one of the reasons we did Lost Boys last week. Because again, I wasn't a big fan, but the rest of this stuff, I'm like, hell yeah. The only thing I'm not looking forward to, honestly, is the It doing It again. I just, but Creepshow, baby.
Yeah, that's
so
great.
I'm looking forward to this.
Very cool.
Well, if you want to get in touch with us, I didn't know Creepshow was directed by Romero. Yeah. Anyway. If you wanted to get in touch with us, you could do that on Twitter. You can find Eric on Twitter at Eric underscore Hotter. You can find me at Twitter at Podcast by Jeff. You can check out my other podcast called The Movie Draft House, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check out GamingNexus.com for all your gaming reviews. You'll see a lot of Eric's written work over there. You can also check out his YouTube channel at Eric Hotter on YouTube. And I think that's it. So we'll see you in 2 weeks for Creepshow.
Thanks, y'all. Bye.